I want to welcome everybody as we continue our fascinating series on the rabbinic response to the rise of reform. But before I start, I want to dedicate this evening's shiur to the memory of Julia Kaczynski, who I'm sure people in Toronto just passed away a few hours ago. But I'm sure news will spread around the world. For those who didn't know, the Kaczynski family, of course, one of the most prominent families in the Jewish world, and Julia was an amazing woman. Dignity, grace, eloquence, her leadership. She was involved in every organization leading. She ran the UGA campaign, Karen Ayasud, the Jewish Agency, Orthodox causes, non-Orthodox causes for the community. It's a real loss to the community. And of course, the Kaczynski name, I think, is associated with every cause that people here hold dear. And I guess on a personal level, on her emotion level, we probably wouldn't be here this evening if not for the support of their family. It was really the Kaczynski family for many years has been a major donor for programs at Torah in Motion. But really, it's a big loss to the community here in Toronto and to the Jewish world, to Canada and the worldwide. And those who met her know exactly what I'm talking about. And those who don't, you can read about her, really quite an amazing woman. And we wish the family Nechama, and we should come together for happy occasions. Okay, thank you.
Well, okay. Come on, was that Julia who passed away?
Julia, yeah, Julia, Henry's wife. Yeah. David, Serena, the son-in-law, just one son-in-law who runs, Leket Israel. That's in Israel. But anyways, yeah, that's Henry's wife, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay, Mark Vakasha.
Okay, thank you. And of course, we also lost another great sage on the other day, Friday, and that's Chaim Kanievsky. I'm sure if you're interested, you've seen a lot written about the huge funeral, and very unique person in terms of his knowledge, and there's a lot to say about him. Maybe another time we can go into more detail in the class. I spoke a bit about him on in the series on my most recent book series, but unbelievably unique, I guess. I mean, just the learning and really something. The date. Let me get the date for posterity, the 21st of March, 2022. A couple of you emailed me about Megillas Esther issues while I was in Jupiter, Florida. First time I ever davened at Chabad. I mentioned this only because at the end of last class, there was some comments about Chabad and Trump. And yes, the first place I was at, they read everything with Trump. I even saw that there's a minhag I didn't know about in Chabad. And I like this minhag that you only shake the grogger when they say Haman's name if there's a title like Haman Ha'agagi or Haman, with some description, not just said Haman. So it was a lot quicker. And since I'm mentioning the Megillah, and a few of you sent me other stuff, including Asher sent me from the Dukian. He picked up on my Ritzafat and a couple others. Let me tell you something else. I should have mentioned it before Megillah, but you'll remember for next year. There's a big mistake that I believe that many shuls make it. Although I have to, because I heard it my whole life growing up, although I didn't hear it with the Chabad. That was very nice. I have to say, though, that I looked on YouTube today and I found like six or seven Ashkenazim reading Megillah, and only one of them made the mistake. And yet I've heard it my whole life. And what am I referring to? And you can text in if the mistake is made in your show as well. Well, first of all, we know that there's a few psukim that they read again when it says Hashmid Arog Ulabed, Hashmid Del Arog Ulabed, and also Bifnehem Lifnehem. Those are doubts as to, they're not really doubts. They're pretty recent, but at least there is a doubt in text. There's a textual doubt as to how to read it. If you go back far enough, you see there really isn't a doubt, but at least there is a doubt. However, in Perek Gimel 3, Pasuk 4, Pasuk Dalid, you don't have a doubt. You have a Kri Ktiv. The Ktiv is Be'amram, and the Kri is Ke'amram. This should not be read Ke'amram and then Be'amram. It's a mistake. And this isn't a question. You are never supposed to read the Ketiv. If it's a Ketiv Ukri, Kri Ktiv, you do not read the Ktiv, you only read the Kri. This phony minhag is maybe 100 years old, and all the Sfarim on Megillas Esther and Tamei HaMikra, and Poskim, they all attack this and say it's a mistake, and no one knows where it came from, but it's very hard to tell someone who's been laying Megillah now 20 years that it's a mistake. And you can text me or email me what they do in your shul, but this is without a question, this is a mistake that should be uprooted. The Gemara tells us you're not allowed to read the Ketiv. You can only read the Kri. One of you emailed me asking, what's the story? I mentioned that Jews playing drums on Shabbos at Simchas. In fact, Goldhaber mentioned in Izmir that at a chasana on Shabbos and a Simchas Torah, they play on the drums. And then he quotes another at a Sheva Brachos, the Chos Jewish Maisa Avram. So someone asks, well, how is that permissible? The question is, what do you mean, how's it permissible? How is it not permissible? Why is it not permissible? What's the problem of banging on a drum? The whole reason you can't play the instrument is you might fix it, metaking. But with drums, there's no, there's nothing, it's not a klisheir. And how do we know that? In Jerusalem, in the Eda Charedit, they don't believe in music at all on Simchas. In fact, there was an old takana in Jerusalem that in memory of the Beis HaMikdash, you would not have music. So you wouldn't have a band like we're used to at weddings. Instead, the only thing they have is they have the drums they play because it's not considered an instrument. And really, maybe you can fix a drum. Like when I say a drum, I mean, there's something you bang, you make a little noise. I saw when I was in Florida, this, every time I'm down there, I think about it, the whole idea of Shema Matakin, because in Florida, it is Makubal, it is accepted among the most from, it's hot down there, to ride to shul on Shabbos on a scooter. So much so that in one of the big shuls that remain nameless, a huge modern Orthodox shul, the rabbi was opposed to it, but he had to give in because the Haredi shuls in the area, the Black Hatters, they're all coming to shul on the scooters. And why is a scooter different than a bicycle? Because a scooter, it's like a tricycle. There's no metaking. It's just a scooter. You just are on it. And you say, well, it's not the Shabbos spirit. You're right. Maybe in theory it's not the Shabbos spirit, but now that everyone's doing it in Florida, it is the Shabbos spirit. So there's no issue whatsoever. Now, I can tell you that where I live in New Jersey, I've never seen anyone use a scooter. But hey, when I moved to Florida, it's maybe because it's hotter down there. We need the scooter. But that's another issue. Shema Mataki. I want to thank Moshe for sending me. I mentioned the Benedictine liqueur and today it was sold apparently, so they don't have it. But this is what the Amshanover use. This is what they use. Maybe some of you remember from your youth, it has the cross right there because it was made by the Benedictine monks. So also, I have to thank Jacob for this, and also Moshe for the following thing. Remember this. I asked, what's this doing in a sefer? Well, hold on. There's a, you can go on Wikipedia. There's a whole entry on this phenomenon. And Moshe sent me this article. Here you have another. If you go to Brussels, you can see this. But I'll just read you what... This article by Victor Kunin, it argues that the fluid emitted by the sprites is not actually urine in the sense of human waste, but a pure and vital water emitted from spiritual beings. And you can read a whole 30-page article on what this image is and what it represents. So thank you for that. A couple more minutes here. Shlomo and one other emailed me. I showed you the video last week of the singing with the guitar, and it was identified as Eli Baer. And someone said, well, that's also the guy who is in Hatzalah. He's actually in Poland right now, I saw. but it's not true. There's two different ones. I never heard of them to begin with, but two people emailed me. They're two different individuals. And finally, I'll get to the bas mitzvah stuff next week. I didn't know if I'd have time. I do have time, but I just want to do one more thing. I see because it's on my papers. It's on the floor over there. I was speaking about reading Torah without truck. So thank you to Jew Well. That's his pseudonym for telling me that in Minhag Frankfurt, they read the Torah in Haftar without Trup on Tisha B'Av. And I looked it up in Rav Zalman Geiger. That's Abraham Geiger, a figure we're going to meet. His older brother wrote all the Minhagim of Frankfurt. And on page 94, he records this Minhag. On Tisha B'Av, there's no Misha Berach. There, you don't say Yashikoach. And also you... you read it with a low voice and without trup. So even more than that, the minhag is that you get an good aliyah without a talis. And there's another minhag that before Birkas HaTorah, mevarachim balachash as Birkas Baruch Dayan HaEmes. Any other places do this minhag? You make the Baruch Dayan HaEmes. And some say v'yeshem mevarachim osa b'shem ha'malchus. So that's interesting, Frankfurt. Well, actually, I don't know if this is from a different sefer, from Yishol Seinu. I don't know if this is Frankfurt. This is the Minhagim of B'nai Ashkenaz. So someone from Frankfurt maybe could tell me if that's your Minhag. Okay, thank you all for this. Let's get going. We're continuing in the sefer Noga HaTzedek. Let's see. Where's my Noga HaTzedek? Here, Noga HaTzedek. And the next individual who has a tshuva here is the famous Rav Aharon Chorin. Really, the first Reform rabbi, openly Reformed. If you want to read about him, there's a number of good articles. For example, Michael Silber has a nice article here in the entry on the in the Yivo Encyclopedia. It's a very good work that's available completely online. So that's nice. You read this article. You read about how he finds halachic justification for prayers in German. We're going to see that in a minute, and an organ. But more than that, because as time went on, he became more extreme. He thought that you can get rid of all sorts of minhagim. He permitted davening without a kippah, traveling on railroads on Shabbos. What Silber doesn't mention, which is mentioned in the Encyclopedia Judaica article, is that he went even further than that, because he supported the resolution. Well, first of all, he curtailed the days of Shiva, so no longer seven. He permitted the writing on Shabbos. And also, it says here, he supported the resolutions of the Conference of the Reform Rabbis in Brunswick. Well, one of the things the Reform rabbis in Brunswick said is that intermarriage is acceptable as long as the local government permits intermarriage. So Rav Aharon Chorin, who starts off as a real Talmud Chacham, a student of the Noda B'Yehuda, an authentic Talmud Chacham, he becomes a real reformer, a radical reformer even. But when he wrote for Noga HaTzedek, he was just a liberal rabbi. He wasn't a reformer. In fact, he had many gedolim who were on his side during the Great Dispute, because one of his early works is devoted to proving that a sturgeon is kosher. This goes back to the Noda B'Yehuda. The Rav of Temeshvar took a sturgeon and he sent it to the Noda B'Yehuda. And the Noda B'Yehuda examined it, and the Noda B'Yehuda paskin that sturgeon is kosher. And many Rabbanim didn't accept this. In fact, there was a rabbi named Grishaber in the city of Pax in Hungary. After the Noda B'Yehuda's death, Grishaber published a piece in which he said that the Noda B'Yehuda, before he died, wrote to me that he retracts his permission. And this was obviously a lie, and because he said he lost the letter that the Noda B'Yehuda sent him. Obviously a fishy tale there. But he said the Noda B'Yehuda retracted it. Unfortunately for Grishaber, the Noda B'Yehuda's son And this Talmud Mufak, the Rav Lezer Fekulis, the Notam Yehuda's son was Shmuel Lando, and the Talmud Mufak was Rav Lezer Fekulis, the Shuv Me'ava, they were still alive, and they made a public statement that this is false, that Grishaber is lying. Rav Shmuel Lando writes to him, we have the Tshuva, Notam Yehuda, I understand why you're lying, because you think it's treif and you don't want people eating it. But if you continue this, I'm going to have to expose you. And Horin, who was a student of the Notab Yehuda, publicly supported his Rebbe. And not only did the Notab, he supported his Rebbe, he had other rabbis who supported him. I'm not sure why there's such a machokas. You'd think that you can take the sturgeon and you can look at it and you can easily determine what's going on, whether that's a real... this is European sturgeon in that area, whether this is these are scales or not. In Europe, the situation was that despite the Notab Yehuda and despite the big rabbanim in Prague, the tide turned against it, and Grishaber published a book with all sorts of letters of other rabbis rejecting the Notab Yehuda. It's not true. And sturgeon basically became treif. It's definitely treif today. As I've shown you in the past, though, and I'll show you again, it wasn't always treif in America. Here is the, from the 1930s, the Agudas HaRabbonim list of kosher fish. And you see right over here, two types of sturgeon, kosher. By the way, right below it, you also have swordfish. And swordfish remained kosher for a lot longer. But by the late 40s, this was no longer accepted in America as kosher. But it was accepted and it was defended. Its kashrus was defended. And I know someone who remembers as a kid, he's elderly now, but as a kid, that they would eat sturgeon. And here is in Hapardes, this ad would appear issue after issue in Hapardes. Hapardes is the journal of the Rabbanim, the old-fashioned European Talmidei Chachamim in America, not the Yeshiva College, Yeshiva Shurim Tzachanan rabbis. These are Pardes is the journal of the Agudas HaRabbanim. So here you have a picture of a sturgeon, and on the left from the Torah, that if it has fins and scales, you can eat it. And then I'll read it in my, my German Yiddish. There's sturgeon fish gefund sich in die Rishima von Agudas HaRabbanim. That is, the sturgeon fish is found in the list of Agudas HaRabbanim for ein kosher and fish. It's a kosher fish. Vosman mag im essen, you can eat it. Their sturgeon fish is sehr geschmack, very tasty. Un gut zu essen, it's good to eat. Them sturgeon fish can men become, and you can get the sturgeon fish at Johnson's Smoked Fish. So, as I said, it's been a long time since, unless someone's going to text in that you had a sturgeon fish. I've never tasted it. It's been a long time since it's been eaten. By the way, in terms of swordfish, I'm not going to go through the whole swordfish thing. We went through it a few semesters ago. I just I spoke about it in Italy, how they used to eat it until 10 years ago. They still might, and the Rav Soloveitchik permitted it, Rav Schechter permits it. What I did find, I was putting together my papers for the trips we're going to have, and I found my email from one of the people in Gibraltar. Those who've been on our Spain trip, you might remember he spoke to us after the show, Shabbos morning. His name is Mr. Balilo. And he writes to me, where is it? He says as follows. I remember in my youth and well into the 70s, we used to eat swordfish in Gibraltar. But since the 1980s, it is no longer eaten. So you see, it's swordfish is it's more complicated than sturgeon. Okay, so let's return to Horin. Horin was one of the people who was asked...
Did we lose him?
That's what I'm wondering. Yes, I'll send him. I assume he'll be back in a second.
And we lost Mark.
Yeah, all right. He'll come back. He'll come back.
I'm certain he will. Well,
I sure hope so. You know, patient. I was just looking to, here he is. Mark, we don't hear you. You're muted. No, we still don't hear you. No. I don't know if you can hear us, but let me write to you. I'll make you a host again. I will, but we should still be able to hear you. Okay. Oh, no, isn't it? That's funny. I don't see. Okay. Mark, do you hear me? We don't hear you. Maybe you want to go
Mark,
off.
Mark, come was in the list of, Mark is not a co-host.
I know that, but I can't find his name. It's not, saw Mark.
It came back and then it disappeared again.
Right. So if you go down. Right, then I saw Mark, but I realized.
Okay, now I'm host again?
I don't know, but I'll make you host.
Okay, I'm sorry. I pressed the wrong button and I left the session as opposed to leaving.
We hear you now.
I have, what I do is I have two things on because I like to see the pictures. But okay, sorry about that. I can't believe it. In like 85 Zooms, the first time I've ever done that by mistake. Last week was a different issue. Okay, so let's get back to. Horin. Get us back here. So this is the third. Remember, we saw already Shem Tov Samun, and we saw Yaakov Chaira Kanati. He was also asked the questions, the same questions that the others were asked. And first he's asked whether about praying in Hebrew, and you don't understand it, or is it better to use the vernacular? What do you think? That's the. The question he's asked, and hold on, let me get my set up my screen again here. So he's asked about what's better to do, he says, "Well, tefillah is avoda shebalev, and since it's avoda shebalev, the most important thing is that you understand what you're saying." And therefore, of course, he says you can pray in the vernacular. If it's a avodah shebalev, you need to understand what you're saying. What good is not understanding? And then he cites the Mishnah. So the Mishnah says as follows. Where's the Mishnah? Here. Mishnah Sota, 7:1. Eilu ne'amarin b'chol lashon. These can be said in any languages. And one of them is Kriyat Shema Utfila. So what's the question? Horan says, of course, you can daven in any language. This is recorded as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in 101, halacha 4. There it is. And then they say that's with a tzibur. But yachid, there's another issue, because the question of what the malachim understands. But Shulchan Aruch says you can daven in any language, as a tzibur, certainly. And the Mugin Avraham on the spot here says that it's better to daven in the language that you understand than to pray in Hebrew if you don't understand it. So now you see where we're going with this. I'll go even further with you. There's a rabbi in the 17th century named Rav Shmuel Aboam. He's he was a Rav in Venice, and he wrote a volume of Chuvos. And if you look at his Chuvos, number 121, first of all, he says that it's okay to pray in the vernacular. So here you have a pre-Reform rabbi in Italy saying that if you want to pray in the vernacular, it's an interesting question. He was asked, there were 10 Jews who didn't know Hebrew. So 10 Jews are together, they're making a minyan, but none of them know Hebrew. So, and there's no one, let's see, not even one person knows Hebrew to be the chazan. So can you have davening in the vernacular, that is in Italian, and can you recite the Kedusha and the Kaddish in Italian? And he says, it's a short shuva, he says, even though this is very strange, he says, t'mua b'enai. He says, you don't even have one person who knows Hebrew. He says, most poskim permit even a yachid to daven in any language. And he says there's no difference in terms of being Yotzi someone, so therefore you can do it. And he brings some proofs that they say, for example, you're not supposed to, certain things are not supposed to be said in a foreign language, so therefore that shows that everything else can. So Jim Tzfila, Birkas HaMazon. And the last sentence says that in Salonika, he says, there is a Chazan Kavua L'Nashim, She'enan Yodot L'Shon HaKodesh, Shemotzi Atzmotan B'Tfilas Laz. He says that in Salonika, there was a women's minyan. Don't let them tell you that women's minyanim is only some open Orthodox thing. They had women's minyanim, but the difference is they had a male chazan. Not always. Sometimes they had a female prayer leader also. They didn't do dvarim shebikdusha, but they had a chazan. And in Salonika, you had a male chazan for this women's minyan. None of the women knew Hebrew, so they did it all in the vernacular. By the way, I'll just mention, since we finished with Purim, how many know that according to halacha, you can recite Megillah in the vernacular, in any language you can? The Mishnah already says that the only question is if you understand Hebrew, can you read in another language? But you can recite the Megillah in any language. The only difference is these words. What pasuk is it? Yes, and... 8:10. Ha'achashtaranim b'nei haramachim. Ramachim. It's not so clear what those words are. So that they say you're supposed to say it in Hebrew, but you can recite it, and they did. They used to recite it in Spain. They recited it in Spanish translation, and Rav Kafach says that in Yemen they would recite it to the women in Yemen in Arabic. So. What's better? Is it better to recite in Hebrew? The Shulchan Aruch holds that it's preferable to recite it in Hebrew, even if you know your Yotze. But there are others who say, at least one other, the Shmuel Masarion, that it's better, no, to recite it in the vernacular. So already we see that you can pray in the vernacular. So now my question to think about as we go forward, and we're going to be, not this class, maybe next class already, we're going to start with the Gedolim's response. How are they going to usher something that is explicitly permitted in the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, and it's also Minhag Yisrael. People would daven in the vernacular. But it's also obvious that if you allow davening in the vernacular, you destroy traditional Judaism like we know it. So how are you going to usher something which is mutter, but if you allow it, even though it's technically mutter, is going to destroy tefillah as we know it? Because all these cases were speaking about people who didn't know any better. That they didn't know Hebrew, so therefore they were forced to do it. But to do this l'chatila, we know where this is going to lead. But the Chorin doesn't think so. Let's go back to Chorin here. So he argues, the first thing he begins is that although you shouldn't use the vernacular for Shmon Esrei and Shemon and Brachos, because it's better, you can easily learn the Hebrew for that. Technically you can, and... you know, the rest of the prayers, you Pesukah de Zimra and the others, which are difficult for people to understand, say it in the vernacular. He then gets to the issue, which we already saw, instruments. And that's, he has no problem at all. He says that musical instruments in shul increase kavana and make the service more beautiful. What about abolishing chazar sashats? No problem with that as well. He says this is an old tradition. We know the Rambam already got rid of it. He says that even dignified people talk during Chazar Sashats. It's not just the hoi polloi. Even people who shouldn't talk are talking, so he says better to get rid of it. And he quotes the Rambam. And then the other issue, what about changing pronunciation to the Sephardic pronunciation? He states that we should go with the Sephardic pronunciation because the Ashkenazic pronunciation is faulty, as attested, he says, by Kol Yode Lashon Umavine Tamam Daktabin. He says anyone who knows grammar and knows about Hebrew language knows the Sephardic pronunciation is better. Now, this is an example of the myth of Sephardi supremacy. Yes, the Sephardim are better in certain areas. They pronounce the ayin, and they pronounce, at least a real Sephardi will pronounce the kuf different than the kaf. But you know, Sephardim also pronounce the ted and the tuf the same way. They don't distinguish between patach and kamatz. So there are things that the Sephardim had get better, but there's other things that the Ashkenazim get better. But that's what he says. And of course, to show that halachically you can change the pronunciation, this was also a big issue with the state of Israel. There's many rabbanim, including Rav Kook, who held that you can't change your pronunciation. It's Al Titosh Torah Simecha. This is our pronunciation. We have to keep to it. But it became impossible because the day school started teaching Ivrit. So at least in modern Orthodox world, many people started adopting it that way. And I don't think today anyone assumes it's a problem. I know Rav Lichtenstein, when he moved to Israel, he davened Sfarik. He started doing it. And then he stopped because he said that it didn't feel like davening to him because it wasn't natural. It was artificial. If you grow up, be the first part of your life doing it Ashkenazic, it's hard to change. I can tell you that I was taught Sephardic, and until I was 12 years old, all my davening and everything was Sephardic. And then I start learning the laning for my bar mitzvah. I said, why should I be different than my father? Why should I be different than everyone else older than, let's say, age 25? So I taught myself Ashkenazic. And when I look at my friends, and we all grew up this way, Sephardic in the traditional Zionist type of day school, almost all of them now, now it's many years already, but almost all of them return to Ashkenazic pronunciation. I was the only one in my class who did Sephardic pronunciation, who did Ashkenazic pronunciation at this bar mitzvah. Everyone else just learned it the easier way, because tough and stuff, if you don't have to distinguish, it's easier. But now I see my friends, they're all Ashkenazic, so which is our minhag. And I'm not such a tzioni that I think you need to get rid of your minhag of hundreds of years. Just if you move there and your kids grow up there, obviously, at least the place I'd send my kids, they'd be saying it to. Incidentally, I love when you hear, I like it, maybe some of the purists wouldn't, when you hear, just listen to Hespedin, for instance, from Ruchaim Kanievsky, listen to a shiur in the Haredi world. It's in Ivrit. But when they quote Psukim, and when they mention traditional things, it's Ashkenazic. So it'll be Shomrim et HaShabbos, you know, and they go back and forth between Ashkenazic and Sephardic. But to show that it's absolutely mutter to change your pronunciation and against what all the Rabbonim were saying when the state of Israel was formed, Chorin cites the famous case of Nosson Adler. Rav Natan Adler, maybe we should say, the teacher of Chosam Sofer, who became convinced that the Sephardic pronunciation was the best, and he taught himself that. He had a teacher. His name was Chaim Modai, the author of Shemos and Shuvos, Chaim Olam. You look on HebrewBooks.org, you'll see it's Chaim Olam. He was a Mashiach, and he lived for a long time. These Mashiachim would come for years. And he lived with Rav Nosson Adler, and that's how Rav Nosson Adler learned. It's not so simple to pronounce an ayin, pronounce the chet. If you didn't grow up pronouncing the chet and pronouncing the ayin, it's and even if you can teach yourself that, I challenge you to teach yourself the kuf or the sadi or the Sephardic sadi. So these are things that they have. Chorin mentions that he himself, as a boy, heard Rav Nosson Adler daven. So if the great Rav Nosson Adler did it, then that makes it mutter. Rav Nosson Adler, if you want to hear more about him and what made him unique and what got him into trouble in Frankfurt, he had to leave Frankfurt. They put him in Cheirim, the rabbis, because in Frankfurt's not the sort of place where you open up your own minyan with your own minhagim. It wasn't just that he davened with the Sephardic pronunciation. He opened up his own minyan, and they davened, the whole minyan davened with the in accordance with the Nusach Ari, with Kabbalistic, like Nusach Sfard. And you can't do that in the heart of Ashkenaz. And he went back down, and they had to put him in Cheirim. And even though they knew he was one of the great Gedolim, they figured it was. And when he came back after going and serving in Boscovitz, then he makes his way back. Then already the Cheirim is lifted, and he's accepted, and he's buried with the with all the great Rabbanim there. This minion of Rav Nosson Adler continued into the Nazi era, this special minion. Rav Nosson Adler is famous, not just for changing the pronunciation, but we have almost nothing from Rav Nosson Adler in print, because Rav Nosson Adler did not write anything. One of the only things we have in print, we'll see as part of the tshuva, is from the next rabbi we'll speak about in his volume of tshuva. Rav Nosson Adler didn't write anything. Supposedly, this is what the... it's in the tradition, the Chassam Sofer's family, is there a Nosson Adler held that we all know that you can't write Torah Shebaal Peh. But since we forget it, we're allowed to write it. It's said that Rav Nosson Adler held that since he didn't forget, he had no permission to write Parasha Baal Peh. And that's why we have almost nothing to him. Now, as for music in the shul, getting back to Chorin, he says the same thing we saw Yaakov Chai Rekhanati, no problem, have the non-Jew play it. And Chorin also records that in his shul, he was in the city of Arad in Hungary, he read the Torah without trup, which he says that the trup destroys kavana, the ein bahem tam, the reach Torah. He says that the Talmim have no tam and no reach Torah, no sense of Torah. Now, I don't see, he doesn't justify this, but other than that reason, but we already saw that the trup is regarded as part of the tradition, well, at least going back to Ezra. Even, I mean, at least that's what the Gemara says. If that's one opinion. The other opinion is deals with the Masoretic type stuff. But still, it's part of our tradition. And for Aaron Chorin to decide in the 19th century that he's going to change Minhag Yisrael, he's going to change Minhag Ashkenaz, going back, you know, 1,000 years, doesn't make any sense to me. And he ends his letter piously, telling the people that in Berlin that they should leave the shul open every day, not just on Shabbos. We'll see what Moshe Kunitz says about this. So here you have the synagogue in Berlin. It's only open on Shabbos. They don't have a daily minyan there. And they want all these heterim, they want these reforms, like a reform synagogue today that's only open on Shabbos. Who ever heard of a shul that's like that? That's Aaron Chorin. Aaron Chorin, as I told you, Aaron Chorin, Rabiner, the Chassam Sofer, we're going to see what he says about him. He calls him Acher. But there's a lot to be said about Aaron Chorin. Supposedly, I don't know, but at least we have sources that say this, that Chorin's descendants were Catholic. I guess eventually they're Catholic because we don't know of any descendants, so they assimilated. But I don't know if it's his children or if it's later descendants. The last of the tshuva we're going to see, and this is the final tshuva in Noga HaTzedek, the fourth one, is a figure that the name will probably be familiar to those who've been with us since I have some of you who've been here since the classes I did on the 53 classes on the latest book. And I also did two classes on Torah and Moshe, and you can see on the website. That's Rav Moshe Kunitz. Rav Moshe Kunitz. So I'm not going to repeat everything as I dealt in detail with him in an earlier semester, but let me just tell you a little bit about this fascinating individual. By the way, I didn't show you. Here's a picture of Aaron Chorin. So, I mean, he looks like a religious person. Hold on. I want to find you. Actually, I discovered that we have a few famous pictures of Moses Kunitz, but I discovered one in the Yeshiva University archives, which was completely unknown. I just want to... it's not pulling up, but here you can see the picture, one of the pictures of him there. I mean, again, he's a Rav. So who's Rav Moshe Kunitz? He's the Rav in the first Rav in Buda. When if you come on my trip this summer to Central Europe, we're hoping end of June, early July, we will see what's called Budapest is actually two cities, Buda and Pest. And Rav Moshe Kunitz was first Rav in Buda, and later he was a Dayan in Pest. And you can go see him. You know that he's accepted rabbi because he's buried right in the row with all the great rabbis. He's even buried right next to one away from Rav Shimon Oppenheim. If you recall, I discussed in the series on my latest book, Rav Shimon Oppenheim, all the Hasidim go there because it's maybe the only grave which gives a guarantee. If you come and say this prayer, I will intercede in heaven for you. And therefore the Hasidim come to that grave. So Rav Moshe Kunitz, he wrote Shelos and Tshuvos. He's most famous for something else. He's an authentic Rav, not a reformer at all. He's most famous for, let's see, do I have it here? This book. Ben Yochai. It's a defense of the authenticity of the Zohar against Rav Yaakov Emden's criticism. And there you have the cave that at the bottom there, Rishon Ben Yochai was in. But this book is, it also lists all the examples where the Halacha and the Shulchan Aruch is based on the Zohar. Very helpful book, very good book. So he's a traditional Rav. And he was asked this question about, there's a lot of nonsense in his book, Ben Yochai, that's clear. But and Yaakov Emden is right on many of these things. But it's still a valuable book. After the tshuva we're going to see right now, Rav Moshe Kunitz fell out, I guess you could say, in the Ashkenazic world, because he was seen in retrospect as defending the reformers, even though he really wasn't. He just was giving a psak without, I assume, knowing the situation in its entirety. But in the Sephardic world, he remained a very important figure, and because they're into Kabbalah and the Zohar. And so he was asked, he gives us the question he was asked. They established a shul in Berlin, and they want to do a few changes. First of all, they want to daven with the Sephardic pronunciation. They want to have the Shliach Tzibur begin after Gal Yisrael, Kol Ram, that is the just one Shemona Esrei, not a repetition. They want to do certain tefillos with the organ, with a non-Jew. That's what they ask him. So he answers. He says, first of all, he speaks in favor of the Sephardic pronunciation. He says that most of the world uses Sephardic pronunciation. He's wrong in his statistics. He says that 7/8 of the world were Sephardic. That's not true. In the 19th century, I have to assume that most of the 19th century, most of the Jews would have been Ashkenazic in the 19th century. In medieval times, they say it like you might have had 1 million Sephardic and in Europe, let's say, and 100,000 Ashkenazic. But by the 19th century, you have more Ashkenazim. But so he didn't know the populations in the Arab world. In volume one of his Chuvos, incidentally, he publishes a responsum of Rav Nosson Adler. This is one of the only things we have in print from Rav Nosson Adler. And Rav Moshe Kunitz must have suspected that some people would question, is it really authentic? Because we know that Rav Nosson Adler never wrote anything. So he includes a letter from the Chasam Sofer testifying that Rav Moshe Kunitz published is authentic. And what he did is Rav Moshe Kunitz sent the original to the Chasam Sofer, and the Chasam Sofer testified that the signature is Rav Nosson Adler. Now, as for abolishing Shemona Esrei, he actually doesn't approve of this. And in the this paragraph, the last full paragraph, where he's asked about Tefillah Barachash, he begins, he's going to give his decision now. He goes, Mishpat Kasuv Adarhu. Remember, we know this from the Pasuk in Tehillim. Wasos Mishpat Kasuv Kama Hadarhu Chochasidav. But he puts them together. The written, I guess the judgment written, it's glorious. I guess I have to read it. This expression, Hadar, is, I just read, Hadar hu chochasidav. It's actually used in another way, if you're interested in Moritzot. When a rabbi retracts his position, that is, when a rabbi acknowledges that he made a mistake, rabbis will say about this rabbi, Hadar hu chochasidav, which in context means, it's the glory of all God's saints. But Hadar in Aramaic means he returns, he retracts. So if let's say Rav Moshe Feinstein retracts his position, Rav Avad Yosef would say about him, Hadar hu l'cho chasidav. He retracted with all piety. I guess that's how you translate it. When we finish a masachta, we say Hadron. Hadron alach v'hadron alad. So what does Hadron alach v'hadron alad mean? Well, I think everyone assumes it means, like I just said, return. Hadron alach, we will return to you, and you will return to us. But it could also mean, some people have suggested it means that our glory is upon you, and your glory is upon us. The Torah, as it were, is glorified through those who study it. And if you're wondering, well, where does that come from? Why would the Torah be glorified by us? Well, there is a pasuk in Yeshayahu 49:3, where God says, Yisrael asher b'cha et ba'ar, you Israel, in whom I will be glorified. So There you got it. So I'm not sure what Hadra, I assume I think that's probably a drash, what I just told you. I think what it really means is we will return to you and you will return to us. Okay, so Ramosha Kunitz, he says that why do we have tefillah barachash? What's the point of davening silently and then just read it out loud when you do it all together? And he says that in every nation, you have silent prayer. We all know silent prayer. Although silent prayer, I don't know how long it goes back. I mean, when Chana said it, Eli thinks she's drunk over there. So why does Eli think she's drunk? If you see someone in synagogue or in church, let's say with their mouth moving, you assume they're praying. Eli sees her and he thinks she's drunk. Must be that in those days, they didn't have silent prayer. You want to serve God, you come to the Mishkan there and you give your sacrifice and they give you something to say. The recyclable language, they if you look at Chana's prayer, it's like it could be used maybe for all sorts of things, but he sees her moving her lips. But since then, at least, I think we can say that we do have silent prayer. And Ramosha Kunitz says there is in Zarut ba'livadel Yisrael miben hamim. There's no reason to make this different. What are you trying to do? Will you make it different? No, this is how people pray. We pray silently. And there's nothing strange in this. You can't say it's a chilul Hashem or anything like this. So no reason to get rid of the silent Shmona Esrei, he says. And he says, especially according to the Gemara. The Gemara says that we pray silently because sometimes in prayers you have confessions. You don't want anyone to hear your confessions. And then he says, that even in the non-Jews, HaKohanim Ba'amin, that means the Christian Catholic priest. He says there, they also do it silently. I mean, they do it to an individual, but it's not, you don't pray out loud. So he rejects, so he's accepted one of the reforms, change the pronunciation. He's rejected the one, get rid of silent Shmona Esrei. Well, what about the organ? Okay, so this is the big one. He says that, well, you know, there's a long history of music in Judaism. We do have a long history. That, there's no question we have a long history. The Maharil, supposedly, the old German Nusach of davening supposedly went back to the Maharil, who's a great chazan. I can't tell you how much it bothers me when I'm at Yeshiva Sheminyanim, and even to take out the Sefer Torah, they don't sing. It's all, they make it seem like this is something invented by the modern Orthodox. It's not true. There always was, granted, okay, communal singing like we have is fairly recent, but you always had chazanim, you always had things, and you had music in Italy going back hundreds of years. So he says that musical instruments have a long history. He mentions how from Malachim, it says that Elisha was given prophecy when the minstrel played. He says that music can attract people who are distant from the synagogue, and it can stir the hearts of the women and children to love God. Shlomo said that he knows of a shul where some guy wanted to do like music, like we saw at a bris, and the rabbi nixed it because of the chasam sofer. But I already showed you the video, so you see that some people do like music, and I can show you other videos as well. And he says, obviously, a Jew can't play it, so a non-Jew plays it. And how do we know that's permissible? Well, he says, non-Jews come in every Shabbos, and they light the candles for us on Shabbos. So if non-Jews can light the candles in the shul, you have to have non-Jews light the candles because the candles would go out. So they, let's say, come in Shabbos morning, light the candles, or Shabbos afternoon by mincha time. It shows you they didn't have these candles that burnt 24 hours. They could have it. We have Yisker candles, but they didn't. I'm thinking perhaps because they were afraid that they would always have these fires in these places, so that maybe they didn't want to leave it burning overnight. It could start a fire. When you start a fire in those places, you burn the whole city down. We have plenty of cases like that. So if we allow a non-Jew to come in and light the candles, we can allow the non-Jew to play the music. And he finishes his the tshuva. He says to them as well that where is it in the last paragraph? He says. I thought it was the last paragraph of the show. He says, I recommend to you, liftoach beis Hashem b'chol yom boker v'erev. He says, open the shul up every day and make sure you have 10 men there for davening. He says, look at your neighbors, the non-Jewish neighbors. He says that there's no time when during the week when the church isn't open, and certainly the synagogue has to. So he also saw that these reformers were not the most pious, so he tells them. He's giving, it's hard to know what's going through his mind. In his shul, they didn't have organs, but he sees that these are people who are not so connected. He wants to keep them connected. So he says, well, okay, here's one thing you can do. You can have an organ with a non-Jew. It's like Kiruv. And if you want to change the pronunciation, change the pronunciation, but you can't get rid of Chazar Sashatz. So he's... I guess he's conservative with a small C. I look at this as him writing a Kirov type of tshuva, but this tshuva would destroy his reputation because after this, even though he was just a regular Rav, he was tainted with the reformers. So these are the four tshuvot in the Nogat Tzedek, and the whole response in the first generation, which we're going to see, the response of the Gedolim is going to revolve around at least a couple of the tshuvot. They're not going to mention. Kunitz isn't even mentioned. It's like they figure, I don't know, maybe it's Nebuch that he got involved with this. It's Horin that they go after. And the Italian rabbis, they also realize. So three of the four were traditional rabbis who gave decisions that are going to be rejected by the Gedolim, but everyone knew that they're not reformers. What happened is, though, for some reason, about 30, 40 years ago, Konitz gets a reputation of being a reformer, and they remove his introduction to the Vilna Mishnayos. The Vilna Mishnayos, I showed you a few semesters ago. If you look in your Vilna Mishnayos, it has his introduction about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. There's a whole biography there. And now they took it out, which is not right, because he's not a reformer, but someone got it in his head that, look, he supported the reformers. Chorin. He had Haskamas from Gedol Yisrael on his far, well, one Gedol Yisrael on his early Sefer. And then his book on Sturgeon, he has a number of Gedolim. You can't look at, something out of its context. Right now, we're dealing with people in Berlin who asked the Shiloh. They're not the most religious, but we have Orthodox shuls today where the people are not the most religious. And sometimes rabbis come up with unbelievable heterim. I can tell you some of the machitzas I saw on some of these shuls. And the answer is that, well, because if you made the machitza any higher, they get rid of the machitza. This is like the most that you can get. So we know about this sort of thing. And that's how I see Rav Moshe Kunitz. So this is Noga HaTzedek. But the Noga HaTzedek was published together with the book by Eliezer Lieberman. Now, he's a real scoundrel. And what I want to do next class is we're going to look at the two reformers are going to be Eliezer Lieberman and Horin. And Lieberman or Noga, you'll see how they refer to these Sfarim. So these are the two reformers. Horin, who's a real Rav, and a Talmud Chacham, and Lieberman, who's not an Amma Aretz, but he's not known as a rabbi, Bechorin wrote Halacha Svarim. So what we're going to do next class is we're going to see the last text of the Reformers in this early generation here, this span of 20 years, where they were arguing for Halacha reforms, and we're going to see what Lieberman has to say, and really what Lieberman has to say also, it makes some sense. If you just look at it, on its own, without considering the broader implications. Everything he's going to say, you can justify. We'll see what the broader implications are going to be later. And then we're going to get to, hopefully next class, we will we'll even maybe begin with the Gedol Yisrael's response. What the Rav said, Rav Soloveitchik said as follows. I heard this from Rabbi Rakefet, who heard it from him, that in discussing this dispute, which we're going to be, Rav Soloveitchik said, maybe it's possible that the Gedolim, the Chosim Sofer Tikkun were too stringent, too strong. That is, had they made some compromises, well, you know, look what they wanted. What they wanted was some limited compromise that could have been justified. Had they made a few compromises and said, like in Berlin, you know, we'll allow you to do this, then maybe we would have been able to stop the reform. But then he said, but you know, on the other hand, had the Chosim Sofer not been so firm, and had the other Gedolim not been so strong, and even forbid things which you could have easily found a way to justify, maybe the reform would have spread much further and been much worse. The significance in this, I think, is that Rav Soloveitchik raised the issue that in retrospect, this is the question we're going to have to ask. Was the correct decision made? That is, maybe by a more conciliatory approach, because reform becomes the dominant form of Judaism, and Orthodoxy becomes a minority. Within two generations, the Orthodox are a minority, and reform are running all the cities. Is it possible that maybe through a little more conciliatory approach, they could have come to some sort of compromise, Peshara, that would have kept the reformers in the fold? I'm skeptical of it, but it's hard to say because it's as a result of the complete failure of the first generation of halachic reform that then they just throw it all off, and then the next generation doesn't care about halacha at all. It's interesting to try to ponder what would happen. And we actually see this repeating in our day because there are very liberal Orthodox who want reforms today. And you have people like Daniel Sperber says that, well, if we don't give them these reforms, like partnership minyanim, the next thing you know, they're going to be joining the conservative movement. That's what Daniel Sperber said. This might be insulting to people who go to partnership minyanim, but Daniel Sperber said that I felt I had to permit it because if not, then it would have led to taking down the machitza and join the conservative movement. And they said this was the way to keep the people, the very liberal ones who wanted more roles for women, in the Orthodox fold. So it's like a b'diavad, but that's, and if you don't believe me, you can hear it. I even think it's on the Torah in Motion. It's either when he was interviewed by Elliot Malamet, or I was at a conference in Detroit. This is going back now 15 years ago. You can hear it on the Torah in Motion website where Danny Sperber explains exactly why he permitted, for people who want to follow what he says, the partnership minyanim. Just go to, I assume you plug in Sperber on the Torah in Motion website, you'll find it. So I'm going to stop here and let me take the questions and the comments. So Justin sends us a very interesting link. The interesting history of Chabad's Benedictine rapture. Yeah, I just knew about the Amshin over. I didn't know about the Chabad. It shows you just because it has a cross. I'm going to be publishing a new blog post later this week. It's supposed to be already today, but I have to go to Scranton. I have to stay over, so I won't get to it. You're going to see Professor Tversky, Yitzhak Tversky, the Tolner Rebbe, my Rebbe. The only video of him in existence, which I discovered, believe it or not, at the University of Scranton in their archives. I then made a DVD of it and put it in the library. And then just 2 weeks ago, I finally decided to put it online. I gave it to the tech people there, and they turned it into a YouTube video. And it's already on YouTube. If you Google it, you go to YouTube and search it, you'll find it. But I'm going to put it on the post so everyone will see it. Tversky is sitting there with a big cross behind him because it's the University of Scranton. I don't know who got the smart idea, but this is at the University of Scranton. Someone put up a big Israeli flag right next to him. So you have the Jewish star. And we have crosses. Now, Shmuel says he recalls reading that the issue with the sturgeon was that its scales were strongly attached to the fish's body. And you're right, they're not considered scales according to the Ramban. That is, and the Noda Yehuda did not think one had to be concerned with this issue. That is exactly the issue. And you see the whole discussion in, Chorin has two books on this subject, and he deals with that. But again, it's you're right. This isn't like a swordfish case. I take back what I said. It's not a question of looking at it and determining is it scales. It's how much do we have to be choshesh for the Ramban's view. Actually, thank you for reminding me. It's been years since I've looked at those books. I have them all, though. They're even on HebrewBooks.org. HebrewBooks.org doesn't know he's a reformer. So you can look at it right now. Ruth says that Breuer's doesn't let the Baal Tefillah use Sfardi. As they shouldn't, because Breuer's is following the old Nusach. And if you go to the shul in Budapest, the Kaczynski shul, there's a sign right where the Chazan davens that says, this is an Ashkenazic shul, Nusach Ashkenaz, no the Asmach Parkani. But they know they're not makpid on if you're an Israeli and you want to daven there, that's not a big deal. But that is correct, that it's not just Breuer's. Other places wouldn't allow it either. They used to not allow bar mitzvah boys. I was reading from the 40s or 50s where they said that the bar mitzvah boy, if he wants to read Kriyas HaTorah, he has to do it with the Ashkenazic. Mel says, I thought Rav Nosson Adler adopted the Yemenite pronunciation. No, no, he didn't adopt the Yemenite pronunciation. He adopted a Middle Eastern pronunciation, which is very similar to the Yemenite, with ayins and chets and kufs, but it's not Yemenite. Yemenite pronounces a gimel with a dagesh in it. Yemenite pronounce it j, repri hajefen. And their gimels is like a resh. So he did not do that. And he was taught this, as I said, by Rav Chaim Modai. Rabbi Shudno, I'm sorry you weren't able to log in. I'm not sure what the issue was there. When you're not here with us, I feel I miss you. Yes, it was the Sephardi pronunciation. There's different Sephardi pronunciations. Many Sephardim, the Sephardi pronunciation of Tunisia is different than from Iraq. Yemenite is like the best. Why do I say it's the best? Because they basically, not completely, but almost completely distinguish between all letters. And we know that. Yeah, so they used to, although they're segals, you know, their vowels are not the same as our vowels, but it's okay. Yeah. Thank you, Belford. I'll give you next class. I have the list from Cecil Roth of populations. It's amazing how the Ashkenazic population grew in 1,000 years versus the Sephardic population in the world. Okay, yes, Amalia mentions Simone de Rossi composed beautiful music. The non-Jews came to the synagogue to hear the music. Indeed. And they also came to the synagogue to hear the preaching of Mudna, who also was a chazan. Rabbi Kelman says, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, we have to allow women to say Kaddish because if we don't, they will soon want Aliyot. Okay. Rabbi Rekefet said, only because it's Purim I mention this, he said that he's very strong in support of women's Megillah reading. Because he says that there's so much today that the women want that we can't give them. If we can give them this, and halacha, you're allowed to, a group of women can come together and they can read Megillah. He says not to allow them is, he didn't use this language, but it's like cutting off your nose to spite your face. What he says is by not doing this, you're just going to drive them away. He says in this generation, we have to bend over backwards. And so it's the same. I know it doesn't... many feminists will see this perhaps as patronizing, but, you know, at the end of the day, the result's the same, whether it comes from patronizing or not. Thank you, Jennifer. Oh, and Ruth says there's a cappella group who sing to Rossi's Tfilot in the Big Show in Venice. Ah, I did not know that. Thank you very much for that. Oh, and Rabbi Kelman gives the link, the interview with Rabbi Sperber. That's the link. But I actually, in retrospect, I think it's the conference that I was at. It was an unbelievable conference. It was Sperber, me, and Natan Slifkin, and Kellner. All of us at this conference. I think that's on the website as well. I think that's where Sperber does it.
I don't remember it's that one. I know. I really have to check from memory.
That's on the website.
Was a conference, and that's why you were the one who convinced Rabbi Slifkin to get a PhD.
Yes.
And, and a lot of people don't know that. It was at a Torah in Motion conference, and Rabbi Slifkin was very knowledgeable, but on his own, but he didn't have any academic training, and Dr. Mark told him he has to go get to Bar-Ilan and get a PhD, and
I wrote the recommendation for him. But that Saturday night get-together is also on the Turn Motion website,
of
right?
Of course.
Yeah, that's where he was.
Yeah, we have to start, you know, publicizing all our pre-Zoom Turn Motion talks, you know, before we were, you know, anyway, yes, go on.
Oh, so someone, you know, I'm always saying that every time you say something absolute, it's not absolute. So privately, someone says to me that Roshomo Miller of Toronto has published a defense of Ba'amram Ka'amram, which appears to have first originated in the Lakewood Yeshiva. Is that true? It's got to go back before the Lakewood Yeshiva, I think. Only because there's someone in my town who's been laning for many years, laning for 40 years or 50 years, and he said that that's how he was taught it in the 50s. So maybe, though, some attributed, he says, to Rav Chaim Volozhin, not true at all. It doesn't go to Rav Chaim Volozhin. And Rav Mazuz, of course, sharply disagreed with his argument. It's not just Rav Mazuz. All the, by the way, the Kinyan Torah, who's the That's Rabbi Horowitz. I think that's from, hold on a second, I made some pages here, from the Eda Charedit's against it. Everyone's against it. There's no, every book on how to read Megillas Esther, all the Masoretic books and all the works, the modern books, they all say that this is wrong, it's incorrect, it shouldn't be done, it's a phony kriyuchtiv that was only recently invented. So hold on, I printed out something. Yeah, who does I quote here? We don't Kinyan Torah. That's Kinyan Torah b'halacha. Now he's the from the Eda Charedis. Everyone holds. I don't know. You have to send me why Rav Miller is defending it and why he's defending a practice that only originated like in the '50s or the '40s. It's not. We know that. The Gemara says, the language of the Gemara, let me read you the language of the Gemara here if I got it. It says about kriyuchtivs. Hold on a second. Bear with me for a minute here. Because I printed it out. Well, first of all, the Shulchan Aruch says it. Everyone says it, that you read the kri. And the... I can't find what I'm looking for. So if anyone knows of any arguments or anything, I don't get it. So Barry, Rabbi Hartman says he's reading a book by Herbert Leventhal. His sermon's very orthodox. And Leventhal says he does not compete with European rabbis. His book is a speech he gave 50 old rabbis and complained young rabbis do not speak enough about Torah. They want to keep Judaism, but it failed. I don't know the book. Yes, Rabbi Yellen, I lost the earlier chats. Naftali said it's okay if anyone can write in if it's important. Naftali says
they want to know if Sturgeon of the conservative movement allows, you know, Sturgeon, but
I think they do. The conservative movement does allow Sturgeon, I believe. Naftali says then volume 10 of Yerusha Seinu regarding Nussan Adler, it's a whole article about his pronunciation. Is there any other things I missed? Otherwise, then we're
nothing
done.
Nothing major. No, somebody complaining. Rav Henkin said they should also only bang Haman at the end, but I agree with Harvey. You know, you want to bang all the Hamans. Come on. That's what you grow up as a kid. That stuff, some fun. The Ramah says that's a minhag. Every minhag in Israel is holy, including the minhag to say noise at Haman. I don't like
that. And I'll tell you something else.
Get out of here. Every Haman you bang.
I'll tell you something else. The reformers did get rid of the banging because they thought it was undignified.
Yeah, of course it's
undignified. So they got rid of it. There, in my town, you have two minyanim, well, more than two, but in my shul, you have in the evening, you have two in the morning. The one where they just read through it without any bagging, and you read through it, and then you have the one where the kids and you could have the bag. Right. So it's like freedom of choice.
I think for the first time ever in our shul, they announced that they were having Wednesday night the regular Megillah reading and then a quick Megillah reading, chick chock. I wasn't at either of those minyanim, but so I don't know. I don't know what happened in the end, but I guess people knew they grow up, they lose their kids. Purim's a time.
First, I thought the reason they were doing this is because of COVID. You wanted to shorten like last year or 2 years ago. So they had just having, but then no, he said it's an actual minhag in Chabad that you only, and it goes much quicker. Says that Rabbi Avigdor Miller did not allow any banging. Probably didn't allow banging because maybe you missed some words. That's a problem.
That's what Rav Henkin was saying.
Words. And then you always have the smart Alex when the guy repeats Haman because you couldn't hear it, they bang again. So the grogger used on Shabbos, is that like a drum? Well, it should also be like a drum. I don't think you can be mitakein it. Finally, last point from Nissan. I would theorize that the nature of Esther, its duality of being both Igeret Dibor Baal Peh and Sefer Bechtav, allow me to read the Ketiv too, as I have done for decades. The problem is that it's not the Masorah reading it. Someone invented it because they made a mistake. They thought it's a Minhag Tos. They thought it was like the other two I mentioned, that it was a doubt of how to read it. Now, it is true that the Radak holds that the reason you have kriyuchtiv is because there was a mistake, but he doesn't say it's a doubt. Kriyuchtiv is not a doubt. it's not a suffix. And therefore, since it's not a suffix, look, if it's the minhag, keep doing it, but it's a mistake. It's a minhag toast that was invented in the 20th century. And I believe the reason has to be, although Rabbi Miller has to say, the reason has to be because they misunderstood and they thought it was a suffix, the priyotiv. It's not a suffix. It's a correction. And you never read the ktiv. You only read the kri.
But nowhere else do we have a doubt where we read both by the other two, by the Fnayim and by Villa Harog.
Well, that's a doubt, and that's why we read two. But that also really is, it's not that old, but at least that's a doubt. It's not a kriyachtiv. This is an actual kriyachtiv told to us by the Masorah. It's a kriyachtiv. So you never read the ktiv. You only read the kri. Simple as that. It's not me making this up. This is it. This is what all the authorities say. Okay.
Thank you. By the way,
I want to let you know, Mark, the name of the book is The Message of Israel by Israel Leventhal, published in 1973.
Okay.
The version he gave is the third part is all about memoir literature. It's fascinating.
I'm writing it down. The Message of Israel. Good.
Yeah. 1973, Israel Leventhal.
I order books into interlibrary loan. I get them like under a week. It's such an amazing system.
I do it too.
Okay, yeah. Very good. I was going to say, I think, you know, Dr. Sperber's line that I heard him say many times was the same way it's forbidden to be mutter what is usser, it's forbidden to oser what is mutter.
And Shach says that. The Shach says that in the introduction to Yerodea.
Right. So, he writes that, he says that a lot, and you know, I just heard the matter. I know when Megillah, I don't understand just halachically how in the world. I was just learning it a little before Purim. How in the world the Bahag comes up with his, the idea that a woman is only obligated to hear the Megillah but not to read it. It's mamash against the Gemara. The Gemara is like 1,000% black and white clear that a woman can be motzi a man for the Megillah twice. It's like nobody argues, and I don't understand. And the Bahag comes along in Tosfot, you know, that's famous, and says, no, women have a slightly lower obligation, therefore they can lane for women, but not for men. And I don't know. Does anybody have an explanation of that Bahag?
But even Bahag holds that a woman can lane for another woman.
Of course. But I don't understand how, I don't understand how the Bahag calls she can't lane for a man. In other words, the Gemara is very clear she can lean for
a lot has been written on that. It's shver. It's docha.
Right. It's how the Bahag Shita. I don't, that's, you know, that's that. Bal Alachoket Olot, one of the early, I guess, Balei HaTosfot. You know,
no, before the Tosfot. He's the earliest.
Right, the Gaonim. I'm sorry. Right. One of the later Gaonim. That is correct. One of the Bal Alachoket, one of the Gaonim says that even though the Gemara says a woman can read on behalf of the man, he sort of reinterprets the Gemara. And that a woman is really not obligated to read the Megillah. She's only obligated to hear the Megillah. But that's not what the Gemara says. But anyways, if anybody has any ideas on that, I'd be happy to hear anything. I'm not aware. Okay. There's such the smart people on our group. I thought somebody would know somebody.
It's too smart. It's how hard it is to give a class to this and wait to the people here on YouTube. It's the toughest class I've ever had.
Well, I take that as a compliment. I think you should take that as a compliment.
You have experts on the list in all different areas. So
Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem.
Who know more about a lot of things than I know. And I'm talking about things that they know a lot better than me. So yeah. I got to be brave.
All right.
By day, you wouldn't want to know what we think about the reason for why the Bahag said what he said. You really don't want to hear it. Not from us.
Okay. Okay, but I don't know enough about the Bahag. Listen, the Bahag was the first person to write what the 613 mitzvot are. The entire study of what the 613 mitzvot begins with the Bahag, and the Rambam, it's not a nice expression, the Rambam wipes the floor with him. The Rambam is so upset at the Bahag, because how in the world can the Bahag include Neiros Chanukah and the Tilat Shadayim? He goes to town, and the Ramban tries to defend the Bahag. The whole literature, this fascinating literature with the 613 begins with the Bahag. And I know Rav Soloveitchik in his younger years used to follow the other famous, the little I know about the Bahag. He was the one who says when the woman lights the Hanukkah candles, the man has to accept Shabbos. The man cannot accept Shabbos later. That's a very egalitarian, very beautiful. You know, the family lights together, that stays together, prays together, whatever. So that was the Bahag. And apparently the Rav used to follow that minhag when he was younger, and then he stopped. But
he says Hanukkah candles, you meant Shabbos.
I meant Shabbos candles. Yeah, when the wife presumably is lighting the candles on Friday night, we know, you know, the men's, they go to shul later. They daven mincha after, you know, the candle lighting, whatever. They drive to shul afterwards.
No, that's what you meant, but you said Hanukkah candles.
Yeah. Oh, I meant the Shabbos candles. Thank you for, okay, thank you for pointing that out. Anyways, I don't know. I can't, it's very hard to talk about the feminism back in the 8th century, you know, but.
That's right. You know,
But I really am very, I don't understand the view of the Baha'i, that it seems to go against the Gemara, and I was just wondering if anybody had any insights on that. But I guess not. Okay. All right. We look forward to learning with you. Tomorrow we have our regular Shirim, two Shirim, Rachel Danziger Sharansky, continue her series on Sefer Shmot, which does connect to Pesach, of course. And then Alex Israel, his second last talk on Eliyahu. That's at 1:11 and 1:00. And then Wednesday, Ari Mermelstein will make his debut for Torah Motion. Professor Ari Mermelstein at the Yeshiva University. He'll be giving a three-part series on the timeless ritual of Pesach through the lens of a historian. And on Wednesday, he'll be talking on the Seder after the destruction of the temple, the changes that went through the Seder. You can imagine it was quite a traumatic experience. So historically, yeah. So that's be Wednesday at 11 a.m. And then, of course, Dr. Sokolow at night, his regular shiur. And Thursday, Shuli Mishkin, a regular shiur in archaeology. And the Parsha shiur this week is be given by Rachel Slutsky. And then my shiur Friday morning, 9 a.m. on the Siddur. Okay, please invite a friend. We look forward to learning with you in the near future, within 24 hours, and a little after 24 hours, 11 a.m. tomorrow. Okay, everybody be well. Laila Tov, thank you very much.
Rabbi Kelman, we tend to forget before many neighborhoods had Erev, right? Mincha and most shuls, because you couldn't carry, started with Adlakas Neros. Whatever had Lakas Neros, that was Mincha, that was Shabbos, because you couldn't carry.
Right.
Shabbos start, you know, what am I going back
for? Right, they start Shabbos.
You had no Erev, you needed to be in shul, you know, by Lakas Neros, because you couldn't carry.
They used to daven earlier. In other words, you know, the davening Mincha, you know, you're supposed to have a Tosefet Shabbos. That means right. You have to get to Mizmor Shir before Shkia. That's
someplace.
Very few shuls do that. Of course, in the summer, we all do that. Those who go to an early minion. But during the winter, yeah, we daven a little bit later than they used to daven, I think, much later than. But, you know, in America, people have to work on Friday afternoon. The Shabbos at 4 o'clock doesn't work to make minion, you know, early. Anyway, but yeah, of course. But okay, thank you. Laila Tov.